Chapter 32. Purpose. He had no sooner found himself in Mr. Irwin's presence than the confidence which he had thought quite easy before suddenly appeared the most difficult thing in the world to him, and at the very moment of shaking hands he saw his purpose in quite a new light. How could he make Irwin understand his position unless he told him those little scenes in the wood? And how could he tell him without looking like a fool? And then his weakness in coming back from Gawain's, and doing the very opposite of what he intended. Irwin would think him a shilly-shally fellow ever after. However, it must come out in an unpremeditated way. The conversation might lead up to it. "I like breakfast time better than any other moment in the day," said Mr. Irwin. "Oh, dust has settled on one's mind then, and it presents a clear mirror to the rays of things. I always have a favorite book by me at breakfast, and I enjoy the bits I pick up then so much, that regularly every morning it seems to me as if I should certainly become studious again. But presently Dent brings up a poor fellow who has killed a hare, and when I've got through my justicing, apostrophe as Carol calls it, I'm inclined for a ride round the glebe, and on my way back I meet with the master of the workhouse, who has got a long story of a mutinous pauper to tell me, and so the day goes on, and I'm always the same lazy fellow before evening sets in. Besides, one wants the stimulus of sympathy, and I have never had that since poor Doily left Treddleston. If you had stuck to your books well, you rascal, I should have had a pleasanter prospect before me. But scholarship doesn't run in your family blood. No indeed. It's well if I can remember a little inapplicable Latin, to adorn my maiden speech in Parliament 6 or 7 years hence. Cross engines et arabimus equer, apostrophe and a few shreds of that sort, will perhaps stick to me, and I shall arrange my opinion so as to introduce them. But I don't think a knowledge of the classics is a pressing want to a country gentleman. As far as I can see, he'd much better have a knowledge of manures. I've been reading your friend Arthur Young's books lately, and there's nothing I should like better than to carry out some of his ideas in putting the farmers on a better management of their land. And, as he says, making what was a wild country, all of the same dark hue, bright and variegated with corn and cattle. My grandfather will never let me have any power while he lives, but there's nothing I should like better than to undertake the Stonyshire side of the estate. It's in a dismal condition and set improvements on foot, and gallop about from one place to another and overlook them. I should like to know all the laborers, and see them touching their hats to me with a look of goodwill. Bravo, Arthur! A man who has no feeling for the classics couldn't make a better apology for coming into the world than, by increasing the quantity of food, to maintain scholars and rectors who appreciate scholars. And whenever you enter on your career of model landlord, may I be there to see. You'll want a portly rector to complete the picture, and take his tithe of all the respect and honor you get by your hard work. Only don't set your heart too strongly on the goodwill you are to get in consequence. I'm not sure that men are the fondest of those who try to be useful to them. You know Gawain has got the curses of the whole neighborhood upon him about that enclosure. You must make it quite clear to your mind which you are most bent upon, old boy popularity or usefulness, else you may happen to miss both. Oh, Gawain is harsh in his manners. He doesn't make himself personally agreeable to his tenants. I don't believe there's anything you can't prevail on people to do with kindness. For my part, I couldn't live in a neighborhood where I was not respected and beloved. And it's very pleasant to go among the tenants here. They seem all so well inclined to me. I suppose it seems only the other day to them, since I was a little lad, riding on a pony about as big as a sheep. And if fair allowances were made to them, and their buildings attended to, one could persuade them to farm on a better plan, stupid as they are. Then mind you fall in love in the right place, and don't get a wife who will drain your purse, and make you niggardly in spite of yourself. My mother and I have a little discussion about you sometimes. She says, I'll never risk a single prophecy on Arthur until I see the woman he falls in love with. Apostrophe apostrophe she thinks your lady love will rule you as the moon rules the tides. But I feel bound to stand up for you, as my pupil you know, and I maintain that you're not of that water equality. So mind you don't disgrace my judgment. Arthur winced under this speech, for keen old Mrs. Irwin's opinion about him had the disagreeable effect of a sinister omen. This, to be sure, was only another reason for persevering in his intention, and getting an additional security against himself. Nevertheless, at this point in the conversation, he was conscious of Ingrid's disinclination to tell his story about Eddie. He was of an impressible nature, and lived a great deal in other people's opinions and feelings concerning himself, and the mere fact that he was in the presence of an intimate friend, who had not the slightest notion that he had had any such serious internal struggle as he came to confide, rather shook his own belief in the seriousness of the struggle. It was not, after all, a thing to make a fuss about. And what could Irwin do for him that he could not do for himself? He would go to Eagledale in spite of Meg's lameness, go on Rattler, and let Pim follow as well as he could on the old tack. That was his thought as he sugared his coffee, but the next minute, as he was lifting the cup to his lips, he remembered how thoroughly he had made up his mind last night to tell Irwin. No. He would not be vacillating again, he would do what he had meant to do this time. So it would be well not to let the personal tone of the conversation altogether drop. If they went to quite indifferent topics, his difficulty would be heightened. It had required no noticeable pause for this rush and rebound of feeling before he answered, but I think it is hardly an argument against a man's general strength of character that he should be apt to be mastered by love. A fine constitution doesn't insure one against smallpox, or any other of those inevitable diseases. A man may be very firm in other matters, and yet be under a sort of witchery from a woman. Yes, but there's this difference between love and smallpox, or bewitchment either, that, if you detect the disease at an early stage and try change of air, there is every chance of complete escape without any further development of symptoms. And there are certain alternative doses which a man may administer to himself by keeping unpleasant consequences before his mind. This gives you a sort of smoked glass through which you may look at the resplendent fair one, and discern her true outline, though I'm afraid, by the by, the smoked glass is apt to be missing just at the moment it is most wanted. I dare say, now, even a man fortified with a knowledge of the classics might be lured into an imprudent marriage, in spite of the warning given him by the chorus in the Prometheus. The smile that flitted across Arthur's face was a faint one, and instead of following Mr. Irwin's playful lead, he said, quite seriously, "Yes, that's the worst of it. It's a desperately vexatious thing that after all one's reflections and quiet determinations, we should be ruled by moods that one can't calculate on beforehand. I don't think a man ought to be blamed so much if he is betrayed into doing things in that way, in spite of his resolutions. Ah, but the moods lie in his nature, my boy, just as much as his reflections did, and more. A man can never do anything at variance with his own nature. He carries within him the germ of his most exceptional action, and if we wise people make eminent fools of ourselves on any particular occasion, we must endure the legitimate conclusion that we carry a few grains of folly to our ounce of wisdom. Well, but one may be betrayed into doing things by a combination of circumstances, which one might never have done otherwise. Why, yes, a man can't very well steal a banknote, unless the banknote lies within convenient reach, but he won't make us think him an honest man, because he begins to howl at the banknote for falling in his way. But surely you don't think a man who struggles against a temptation into which he falls at last as bad as the man who never struggles at all? No, certainly. I pity him in proportion to his struggles, for they foreshadow the inward suffering which is the worst form of nemesis. consequences are unpitying. Our deeds carry their terrible consequences, quite apart from any fluctuations that went before, consequences that are hardly ever confined to ourselves. And it is best to fix our minds on that certainty, instead of considering what may be the elements of excuse for us. But I never knew you so inclined for moral discussion, Arthur. Is it some danger of your own that you are considering in this philosophical, general way? In asking this question, Mr. Irwin pushed his plate away, threw himself back in his chair, and looked straight at Arthur. He really suspected that Arthur wanted to tell him something, and thought of smoothing the way for him by this direct question. But he was mistaken. Brought suddenly and involuntarily to the brink of confession, Arthur shrank back and felt less disposed towards it than ever. The conversation had taken a more serious tone than he had intended. It would quite mislead her when he would imagine there was a deep passion for Hetty, while there was no such thing. He was conscious of coloring, and was annoyed at his boyishness. "Oh no, no danger," he said as indifferently as he could. "Don't know that I am more liable to your resolution than other people, only there are little incidents now, and then that set one speculating on what might happen in the future." Was there a motive at work under this strange reluctance of Arthur's which had a sort of backstairs influence, not admitted to himself? Our mental business is carried on much in the same way as the business of the state. A great deal of hard work is done by agents who are not acknowledged. In a piece of machinery, too, I believe there is often a small unnoticeable wheel which has a great deal to do with the motion of the large obvious ones. Possibly there was some such unrecognized agent secretly busy in Arthur's mind at this moment. Possibly it was the fear lest he might hereafter find the fact of having made a confession to the rector a serious annoyance, in case he should not be able quite to carry out his good resolutions. I dare not assert that it was not so. The human soul is a very complex thing. The idea of Hetty had just crossed Mr. Irwin's mind as he looked inquiringly at Arthur, but his disclaiming indifferent answer confirmed the thought which had quickly followed, that there could be nothing serious in that direction. There was no probability that Arthur ever saw her except at church, and at her own home under the eye of Mrs. Poyser. And the hint he had given Arthur about her the other day had no more serious meaning than to prevent him from noticing her so as to rouse the little chit's vanity, and in this way perturb the rustic drama of her life. Arthur would soon join his regiment, and be far away. No, there could be no danger in that quarter, even if Arthur's character had not been a strong security against it. His honest, patronizing pride in the goodwill and respect of everybody about him was a safeguard even against foolish romance, still more against a lower kind of folly. If there had been anything special on Arthur's mind in the previous conversation, it was clear he was not inclined to enter into details, and Mr. Irwin was too delicate to imply even a friendly curiosity. He perceived a change of subject would be welcome, and said, "By the way, Arthur, at your colonel's birthday fete there were some transparencies that made a great effect in honor of Britannia, and Pitt, and the Loamshire Militia, and, above all, the generous youth, apostrophe the hero of the day. Don't you think you should get up something of the same sort, to astonish our weak minds?" The opportunity was gone. While Arthur was hesitating, the rope to which he might have clung had drifted away. He must trust now to his own swimming. In 10 minutes from that time, Mr. Irwin was called for on business, and Arthur, bidding him goodbye, mounted his horse again with a sense of dissatisfaction, which he tried to quell by determining to set off for Eagledale without an hour's delay. Book 2, Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.